Welcome to the Edu All-Stars Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome to the 12th episode of Edu All-Stars. We are a podcast that exists to share inspiring stories of people from the educational world. We want to thank you all for your feedback and ratings recently on Twitter and iTunes. My name is Todd Nesloni. I'm one of your hosts. On Twitter, you can find me at TechNinjaTodd.
And my name is Chris Kessler. You can find me on Twitter at IamKessler. Our third host, Stacey Huffine, is not with us tonight. She had a previous engagement that she needed to take care of, but she's with us in spirit as always.
And our guest tonight that we are really excited to have is Jack Andreka. He is a Maryland high school sophomore who, at age 15, invented an inexpensive and sensitive sensor for the rapid and early detection of pancreatic, ovarian, and lung cancer. His invention earned him a grand prize at the 2012 ICEP Awards. He's formed his own company, been on countless radio, newspaper, television, and magazine interviews, and he's also a TED and TEDx speaker and winner of the Smithsonian American Ingenuity Youth Award, and most recently selected as a White House Champion of Change. Jack, you want to go ahead and just say hey and to give us your Twitter handle?
Hi, I'm Jack Andreka, and my Twitter handle is at Jack Andreka. And that's J-A-C-K-A-N-D-R-A-K-A. I don't have one of the fancy banners.
Well, so we'll go ahead and jump right in. So like I said, thanks for being here, Jack. We really appreciate it. You are our first student guest, so we're excited to have a different perspective on the show. But we wanted to learn a little bit more about your learning before we jump right into your invention. So looking at yourself as a student, especially early on, what kind of student were you?
So in my elementary school years, I wasn't the best kid. I suppose I got a bit bored in my classes because I went to this private school that was a bit, it didn't have a strong math and science program. Like, for example, in the fifth grade, they taught us how to read clocks in our math class. And oftentimes we'd be switched out of math class into let's make clay pineapples class. So I suppose that was kind of why I was a bit disruptive back then. But then I transferred into public schools, and I realized that my other school had been really, really far behind. And so then I went to a public school that really specialized in STEM, and now I am in high school and going into my junior year in 2 days.
That's awesome. So you're known for this test, which we'll get into in a minute, and how your whole story basically about the test. But what really kind of inspired you to even create this test? What got you just excited? How did it even enter your mind?
So I've always been really passionate about doing scientific research. I suppose I really got interested in science when I was 3 years old. My parents really introduced it to me. Me and my brother did all these crazy little experiments. And then I did my first real scientific research in sixth grade when essentially at my middle school science fair was mandatory. And so I did sixth, seventh, eighth, and then in my ninth grade year, I wanted to do a project on pancreatic cancer research, specifically because a close family friend who's like an uncle to me passed away from the disease when I was 13 years old. And upon further research, what I found is that really there's no standard for diagnostics of pancreatic cancer, but also the current tests are outdated, expensive, and extremely inaccurate. So I was really passionate about finding a new way to detect it.
So let's get into the story. So you've got this passion, you're ready to do this. Where did you even start? Walk us through the story, and just all the way to, you know, kind of up to where we are today. If you can give us like your 5-minute version of your 10-minute TED Talk, how about that?
Yeah, sounds like a plan. So essentially what I first did is I went onto Google and Wikipedia, and I thought, well, with pancreatic cancer, a lot of the standard tests are looking at these different proteins in your bloodstream. And so I thought, maybe if I could find a better target for a protein to detect, then that would increase the sensitivity and selectivity of my test, and thus the accuracy. And so essentially what I did is, using Google, I found a list of 8,000 different proteins that are found in your bloodstream when you have pancreatic cancer. However, a lot of the problems with those markers were they were found in other diseases. So, for example, one of the common ones was chronic pancreatitis, which is an inflammation of your pancreas. And it looks the exact same on, like, scans and stuff, but it's a completely different disease. So I went through this list of different biomarkers, essentially looking at each of the validity of them. So, for example, what different bodily fluids it was found in, because, for example, I can't do like a spinal tap on someone for a screening test. But then also, for example, I had to assess how sensitive it was, how many cases it was stirred up in, and also if it showed up in other tests. So then on the 4,000th try, I finally found one protein named mesothelin. And mesothelin is your ordinary run-of-the-mill type protein. However, one of the really cool parts is that it's found in the very earliest stages of the disease, when someone has close to 100% chance of survival. But also, what's so cool is that it's just recently been discovered, and there's been this explosion of research on it, so it was a really good candidate for me doing the research on. So then what I did is I essentially turned my attention to actually detecting that protein, thus the presence of pancreatic cancer. And I actually had my epiphany in my middle school biology class, and essentially what happened is I snuck in this paper on what are called carbon nanotubes, these long thin pipes of carbon that are an atom thick and 1/50,000th the diameter of your hair. So extremely small, but they have these incredible properties, kind of like the superheroes of material science. So I was reading this paper on all of those properties, and in my biology class, we were learning about these things called antibodies, which are essentially like lock and key. They only react with one specific protein, in this case, the mesothelin. So then I kind of had this like spur-of-the-moment idea that maybe if I stuck the two together, I could get something cool. And as I kept developing the idea, I thought, hey, that might actually work. Because if you weave these antibodies into this network of nanotubes, then you have a network that only reacts with one specific protein, but also will change its electrical properties based on the amount of protein present. And then all of a sudden, I realized, hey, I'm going to need a lab to do all this research, because I can't do this on like my kitchen countertop. And so then I contacted about 200 different professors at Johns Hopkins University and the National Institutes of Health, asking them, hey, can I work in your lab? And on the, God, like 199 rejections out of those, everyone just said no, except for this one guy, Dr. Anirban Maheshwari from Johns Hopkins University. And he said, okay, maybe I might be able to give you like the time of day to listen to your idea. So finally, after 3 months, finally went into his lab and went through this big interview and finally got in. And 7 months later, I popped out with this test.
Now, you mentioned several times in there 4,000 tries and 199 rejections. Was there ever a point where you thought, this is never going to work? I don't even know why I'm doing this anymore. This is a waste of time.
Kind of. During my process, I had to optimize a lot of different procedures because essentially what happens is I make this paper test where I essentially take some filter paper and dip coat it in these carbon nanotube antibodies. And it sounds really simple to produce these, but you have to do a bunch of these scientific procedures before that. One is called the Western blot, and that's for optimizing what antibody should go with a protein. So I was optimizing my antibody, and it's this horrible scientific procedure. It just makes you want to gouge your eyes out because it takes 2 days per test. Then, after you finish that 2 days, it all depends on exposing this film to that to your little gel. So if you expose too long, then you screw it up. If you expose too little, then you screw it up. And if you have made any tiny little mistake before that, you screw it all up. So it took me a total of 3 months and countless tries to get that stupid thing to work. And halfway through that, I'm just like, why am I doing this anymore? What, like, I was like just in like a nosedive of just like despair. And so eventually I was just like, I'm going to pursue through this. Eventually I will get the right one. And soon enough, I did. So essentially, just beat your head against the wall until the wall breaks.
And was it discouraging for you to receive all those rejection letters as well?
The rejection letters were pretty discouraging because, I mean, my mom and my dad and my biology teachers all told me no. And I was like, does anyone believe in this project? Like, at least they didn't, like, tell me to go make a papier-mâché volcano instead.
Right.
But, eventually, like, I was just like, well, screw all these people. I'm not going to let some PhDs who are cynical about the world tell me what to do. So I suppose my rebellious streak kind of helped me out here.
Well, and I know at one point when you were telling me the story, you had said that when you were called in, they tried to poke holes in every single part of your research, right?
Yeah, so the what I had to do is I had to go through this humongous interrogation pretty much to get into that lab. So I walk in, all prepared, and I'm just like, my idea is freaking amazing. Like, they're just going to be like, wow, by me. They're going to be like, Thomas Edison, go on Time Magazine. And then, like, reality struck, and they're just like, so tell me about yourself. I'm like, standard interview question, you got this, Jack. But then it devolved into, like, them just, like, throwing rapid-fire questions at me, like, plastered against the wall, like, white face. I'm just like, I don't know the answer to this. And then eventually I, like, throw out a guess, and it was apparently, like, satisfactory because they're like, okay, whatever. So eventually they let me in. However, I learned that professors aren't nearly as nice as their profile pictures make them appear. They're actually very mean. No offense to any professors. Some of you
we're teachers. We're nice teachers, too. So. There's this saying that we have in education, Jack. It goes something like, smartest person in the room is the room. And I think in this case, the smartest person in the room is Jack Andreka. It's definitely not the room in this case. So
I would not say that.
going back to school, let's go back to middle school or maybe even before that. What are some of the qualities that you found in your teachers that maybe allowed you to be successful going forward? Think about some of the teachers you had that helped you along the way, and what were those qualities like that allowed you to be successful?
So before my middle school, like, age of science, there was, like, the dark ages where, like, I hated all of my teachers because essentially they're all about rules, and me being a young boy, I hated doing rules, so my pencils were never lined up, and I was disorganized, so I didn't really like any of those teachers. The teachers I really liked, they were really passionate about their subject, and essentially they would just, you know, like, they would stay after school and do all these things. That was typically the teachers I had the most contact with that were my favorite. Mm-hmm. And really just teachers, it's, like, hard to put a, like,
Would you say they, like, maybe allowed you to be more creative in class than worksheet or something?
Yeah, so the one thing I hated about some of my math teachers is that they taught formulas when that's not really what math is about. Math is more about, like, doing proofs and cool little, like, mathematical, like, experiments and stuff. And so I only had really one teacher that let me do stuff like that, and that was my sixth grade algebra teacher. He actually let me, like, play around and stuff. And also my, like, the school's, like, other math teacher, she was super, super nice. So those two, like, let me just goof off in class and do these cool mathematical, like, investigations. And so I think those classes were probably the most effective classes for me. And I've had some, like, in middle school, a lot of my science teachers weren't the best. For example, they would sit down, play a video, and then sit back and watch us. And so that wasn't the most effective way of teaching us. But
right.
In my high school, there are some teachers that are really hands-on. And what I really like is when they don't give you, like, instructions to do an experiment. Instead, they're like, find a way to do this that has a basis in chemistry. And that's what I love, is really making kids think more and making science more accessible.
Now, yeah. You've been pretty successful with what you've done. So when you go into school now and you have these science teachers, do they kind of look at you differently?
That would be when I go to school. I have a 10% attendance rate last year. So
oh, man.
I wasn't there very often. But when I do go into school, what I really like is being able to talk to the teachers about different, like, lesson plans and having these cool little debates with them. That's what I really like. And they do look at me a bit different. However, I think, like, really every kid in my school would be able to achieve what I've done.
Yeah, to me, what I'm hearing, Todd, is that project-based learning, hands-on learning, that really, you know, was beneficial to Jack and his, you know, in his scholastic career. So I think those teachers that are, you know, moving towards that direction really are going to have a leg up in the future doing those kinds of things.
Now, Jack, has science always been your favorite subject?
Science and math. However, I've recently discovered a new passion, which is government. I love debating government. It's the funnest thing ever.
So would you consider a future in politics?
I do confess I did skip AP chemistry several times for my AP US government class. So
the government kid was a little more fun for you then.
Yeah.
Well, the teachers that you have in your school, do they use a lot of technology?
No, I'm afraid to say the teachers at my school, some of them use technology really effectively. Mm-hmm. Others try to use technology and kind of like face plant in the process, instead making the class even more like dull and banal.
Well, and as a student, what are you looking for when you want a teacher to bring technology in?
So when I'm looking for a teacher to bring technology in, what I really love is the DIY community, where you essentially make little machines yourself and are essentially, for example, like you can make a DNA sequencer for $85 now. So that'd be like a cool little project to do in like a chemistry or biology class. And right. So I really think bringing in like technologies like Arduino and Raspberry Pi, those would be really effective at teaching. And then also, there's been this big trend in cell phones, and I really like that, particularly because your cell phone is like a walking lab instrument. I mean, your camera is so powerful, as well as all the other analytical grade equipment on it, and also it has Google on it, which is my best friend.
So if you were to walk into a classroom, let's say, that what kind of technology would you absolutely was a must-have for a science lab, let's say? Like for a science lab, yeah.
So I would say your cell phone. That is a must-have.
Yeah.
You just have to have it because you can do so many things with it. I mean, like, you can make a spectrometer on your cell phone, like a really basic one. However, it still gets the job done. And teaches and kids can make it themselves and learn all about the optical properties or chemistry or biology. There's so many things you can do with it.
Yeah, that's cool.
So moving into ICEF in 2012, what was that moment like when you won the grand prize? And do you even remember it? Because I know there's video online of it, but is that one of those moments where it was like so surreal that it's all a blur in your memory?
No, I can still remember like gasping for breath as I like wander and stagger down like the little aisle going up onto stage. I still remember that quite vividly. And the big reason why I was just like freaking out there was because that had kind of been my like childhood dream. I mean, my brother had gone to ICEF for 2 years, so of course there was a sibling rivalry. But also my like childhood dream had been like just to go to ICEF. And like at age 6 I looked in there and like all I want to do is go to ICEF. And so
for our viewers who don't know what ICEF is, do you want to go ahead and explain it and how you get accepted into it?
Yeah, so ICEF is the International Science and Engineering Fair, and it's the largest pre-college science fair. And one of the things is that it's only accessible to 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. And it's from all over the world. So it's essentially like the Olympics, but for a science fair. And is possibly the best scientific experience any student can have. I mean, it's just the best. You get so many ideas and your experience to so many different things. So like, for example, you can learn about like pesticide contamination from people from Tajikistan, or learn how to turn banana peels into plastic from Turkey. I mean, like, it's so cool, just like the huge convergence of science in one area. And awesome. The grand award, of course, is a nice $75,000.
Is that money going toward college, or is that just like put away for a rainy day kind of thing?
It is a necessary college tuition, and I can't transfer it, so.
Well, that's all right. That's good.
Yeah, I can't buy like a new car. Like
that was one of the things I was wondering: is if they just hand you $75,000, or if it's kind of like in scholarships.
Yeah, like a giant case full of like $100 bills. Yeah.
Like you want to?
I was gonna buy like a new, like, really fancy sports car and just go drag race it.
So did you get any actual money that you can touch from that?
Yes, I did. I got $25,000 in special awards because also there are just like thousands and thousands of dollars in special awards. Like I got the Google special award for $10,000, and then you got to go to the Google headquarters and see like crazy things. Like they have a trapeze hammock in there. I'm like, this is the coolest. And they shoot Nerf guns at each other. I'm like, I want to work at Google.
Yeah.
And then like you get all these different things that range from scholarships, cash awards, to just the possibilities are like endless there.
Did you have any idea that you were going to win grand prize? I mean, even
inkling? No one expects to win ISF, let me put it that way. The projects are just like all PhD thesis like level, and it's pretty intense. Like walking up and down like the medical field, which I was in, it was like, I cured cancer, yep. And then, oh, I found a cure to Alzheimer's. I did this. And like, it's just like, oh my gosh, how am I going to compete against this? I like dip paper in nanotubes. Like, what am I going to do?
Go ahead.
It was definitely a very fun experience, though. Yeah.
Very cool. I'd like to go there and check that out.
It's an onlooker
for sure. So how long until we see this test like get put out into mass production? I mean, are you still going through stuff right now? I mean, are we years away from this? Or
so right now, I'm talking with several large biotech companies about getting it commercialized, and we're looking at a bunch of different pathways to see if it has to get FDA approval or not. And so it's a bit from the market, so probably like 7 to 10 years.
Oh, wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, the FDA is awful.
So you mentioned earlier a sibling rivalry. How does your brother react to all of this?
Well, my brother has had his share of the glamour. I mean, he won this huge award at ISF 2 years before me, which was a $96,000 scholarship. He got into MIT Think. He recently won the National Siemens We Can Change the World competition. He finished second in that. So he's had quite the whirlwind as well. So, however, now I can say I have like a leg up on him. Like, oh yeah, I got the Gordon Moore Award.
So that's a lot of talent in one gene pool.
Yeah, I was going to ask about your parents. So what do your parents do?
So my mom is a nurse anesthetist, and my dad is a civil engineer.
Okay.
And so it's definitely not the food. I mean, I have Kraft mac and cheese every single day, so I'm not
a food room. However,
I think it's mostly, and they really just, it was kind of like a scientific experiment, to put like kind of bluntly. They essentially they're just like, okay, what are you interested in? So they took us through all of the sports, and they realized I had no athletic potential. I got like hit in the face with a soccer ball, pegged with a football. I was hopeless at like everything in that respect, except for kayaking. I'm okay at kayaking. Then they were like, okay, do you like music? And then they realized I was like tone deaf or something. Then eventually I was just like, science and math, that's what I'm going to do. So then I did science and math, and I liked it. So they just tested a lot of different things and said, do you like this?
Now, so are you and your brother the only two from the only siblings?
Yes, we are two brothers, one older by 2 years, so he beats me up.
Okay, awesome. So another thing that really was cool that happened to you in the past year was you got to attend the State of Union Address, correct?
Yes.
And what was that like?
Well, so I was, like, incredibly excited, but also surprised, because I was, every few years, they, like, invite, like, the ISF winner, some science fair winner. However, the year before me, they hadn't invited one, so I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm not going to get invited. I only dip paper in water. And so then when I got invited, I was, like, screaming, and it was, like, less than 24 hours before the event. So I'm just like,
oh, wow.
Well, good thing I'm in town that day. Then again, I wasn't going to say no to the State of the Union. So
who called you? Did one of the staffers call you, or did the first lady actually call
staffer.
You?
Yeah, it was Obama. He's just like, yeah, this is Obama. Like, hey, Barack, how's it going? No.
Hey, well, us normal people, we don't know what those experiences are like. So.
No, it was I think it was one of the interns there. And they called me, and they're really nice. But at first, I hung up on them because I'm like, prank call, go away. I'm already in like this cynical, depressive state, like, I'm not going. And so then when I got the call, I was like freaking out. And I go, and the thing about the White House is they tell you, oh, get here like 3 hours before. I mean, you're going to be doing stuff. No, you just kind of like mill around for a while. So be fashionably late to White House events is my advice. And so then we got to like have these amazing hors d'oeuvres and stuff, and Michelle Obama wore like 17 different dresses to the thing. I'm just like, how many dresses do you need to wear, Ms. Obama? Really? Are you really going to like switch 7 times? Let me, then what did we do? Oh yeah, we went over, and because my parents got to come, and I was talking to this one guy, and I was like, oh, this guy's so nice. And it turned out it was Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple. And he's like, yes, a close family friend of mine died from pancreatic cancer, and that was Steve Jobs. Luckily, we had
iPhones
for taking the pictures with him. So it was
Oh, my gosh. Wow. I mean, wow.
So then we went over to the event, and I sit down, and I'm just like, because there are so many people, I'm sitting on the stairs like, ah, this is so much fun. Oh, my gosh. And little did I know, there's a very, very nice lady sitting next to me. And she told me all about, like, the politics and stuff and when to clap and when to not. And she's like, oh, hi, I'm Valerie Jarrett. I'm like, hi, I'm Jack. And later I realized she was the senior advisor to President Obama. And I'm just like, oh, well, then I sat next to Time 100 lady. Ah, of course. So, yeah, it was tremendous experience. I loved that.
And didn't you got to meet the president on like a separate occasion, didn't you? Or was that
So I met him. So essentially, I got to take a picture with him after he gave his speech.
Okay.
And then I kind of like pseudo met him at the White House Science Fair. He gave me a little shout out there. So pretty nice to get a shout out from the president.
Yeah,
but
pretty sweet.
Yeah. So it's been a blast. Yeah. I so now go over to the White House just to play basketball.
Yeah.
I don't actually do that.
Typical 16-year-old stuff that Jack does.
Yes. Exactly. So last week I saw your Twitter feed. It looks like you won a White House Champion of Change Award. What is that about?
So the White House Champions of Change, every like week, I believe, they choose it for one topic. And mine was open access to science articles. Because that's one of the things I'm very passionate about, and I've given several talks and advocated for it. And essentially what happens is there are these paywalls on scientific literature. So say you're a preeminent scientist, and you've come up with a revolutionary cancer treatment, for example. And you want to publish, you have to get your results out, or else you don't get any grant money, and then your lab closes. So it's publisher perish, and so you want to publish in very prestigious journals like Nature or Science or Cell. And so you publish. However, once you publish, you are essentially transferring over your copyright for that information. And those journals put a price tag on it. It costs $35 per article for 48-hour access. But then also, if you want, like, say, a subscription, it's about $40,000 per subscription bundle. Wow. So it's inherently expensive, and kids like me just can't really afford that. I mean, when Harvard University issues a statement saying, well, we just can't afford any of our scientific articles anymore, they're just too expensive, and they have multi-million-dollar budgets, think of me, I make like $5 here and there, I'm not like rolling cash like those libraries. I can't really afford these articles. So it's been a really huge problem for young researchers like me, and also for the entire research community. So I'm really passionate about really breaking down those walls and making it publicly available, because a lot of this information is publicly paid for by tax money in these grants. However, then you have to pay for it again to get access to it, which just doesn't make sense. So we've had some really important progress in that field. Like Obama recently issued a statement saying, okay, all of these have from the top 12 scientific institutions, like the NIH and the Department of Defense, all the big funding areas, they have to make all papers that are funded by these have to be publicly available after 12 months. And then also we currently have legislation going, and so it's pretty exciting.
So let's talk about this for a second. My mom was a science teacher growing up, and just conversations I've had with other science teachers and just in my experience in schooling and everything, I just want to get your opinion on this. Scientists, I think by nature, are kind of, they want to keep the science themselves and not share with the world. What is your opinion on all that?
I would not say that.
Would you disagree with that?
Are really big into open access. I could see that just from the other champions of change. So, for example, there's a Stanford medical professor. There are several biotech professors. Then also there is a physics professor from Cornell. All of them were huge advocates of open access because not only does it make their lives easier and the public, it just improves science because science benefits from the unrestricted flow of technology and scientific data. Yeah.
That's great to hear from an actual scientist, that, or, you know, just from someone that's in the general public, that scientists are actually out there sharing stuff that is better for the public.
We're not these snooty elitist scientists. I like, no, only I can do research. Other peasants can do it. No, we're not like that. So
that's good to
know.
We're
actually very nice people.
Have you had any pushback from any major companies or anything about you constantly going out and talking about open access?
A lot of the open access movements have been receiving some pushback, particularly from journals. So Elsevier, I always butcher their name, Elsevier, it's this huge conglomerate of 7,000 journal titles, and it's been doing huge amounts of lobbying for anti-open access because that's how they make their profits. However, they're not even U.S.-based. They're, like, over in Europe. So these are really exclusive journals, and they've commoditized scientific research. And that's a huge problem for getting youth interested in science, because science is just this thing that's really inaccessible, like, and you can't really access it, whilst you've made pop culture instantly available to everyone. I mean, you can go online and buy a song for 99 cents. Imagine if you could do that for a scientific article. And so that's one of the big things, is increasing the accessibility of science will really improve our education system.
Is there ever a moment where you just wake up or you're just sitting there and you go, wow, this is my life. I'm going to the White House. I'm traveling around the world. I'm inventing these things. I mean, does that ever hit you, or is it all just too big to comprehend?
So half the time it's just like this whirlwind. I don't really have any time to think. I'm like on a day-to-day basis. I'm just like, okay, what's going to happen in the next few hours? Am I going to miss a phone call? Am I going to like... shoot, what's happening now? Did I forget to write something down? And then the other half of the time, I'm sitting on the couch playing games on my phone now. But what essentially happens is a lot of the times I'm just like, this is freaking incredible. I can't believe I'm doing all this stuff. It's unbelievable. I'm just like, oh my goodness, this is like ridiculous. Like, I could have never imagined this life if I was like, 2 years ago. I'm just like,
right.
Me going to the White House? I'm not that important.
So one of the things we like to talk about with guests on the show are just kind of trends in education. And since you kind of bring a student perspective, which is different than most of the guests we have on, I just wanted to go with the student issues. And one of the big things that we always deal with in all the, definitely in all the public schools, I'm sure private schools deal with the same thing, is bullying. So that's a big topic right now. Is that anything that you had personal dealings with, or do you see it in your schools?
I mean, maybe a bit in seventh grade, but that's just because I was being kind of a jerk back then. I don't really see any bullying. However, then again, maybe I'm just like too socially awkward to like really notice it. Maybe I'm just like, oh, whatever, just stop talking to me. But I do have friends. Like, I do have, like, close-knit circle friends. I mean, joke around, but, like, you know, like people just don't, like, the football team captain doesn't, like, beat me up and shove me into the locker. No,
I'm not asking that. But...
no, my high school doesn't have any of that. So.
I mean, okay. But when you go back to school after being gone at all these incredible things you're doing, we mentioned earlier about, do the teachers treat you any differently, but do the students treat you any differently as well?
So apparently I'm this huge debate at my school upon whether or not someone likes me or not. I'm just like, half the school like hates me apparently. I'm just like, I have no clue why. Then the other half of the school like vehemently defends me. I'm just like, okay, whatever.
Welcome to high school.
Yeah, I'm just like, whatever.
You're not unique by any means.
Yeah, I'm just like, yeah, but then again, like, I don't really care about, like, that half the school's opinion, so.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you were telling me about recently was this XPRIZE that you got a team of youth together for to try and work towards. What are y'all doing with that?
So what we're working on is the Tricorder XPRIZE, and it's sponsored by the Qualcomm Foundation. And essentially, it's a $10 million prize to develop something the size of a smartphone that you pass over your skin and diagnose any disease instantly. So there's a lot of company investment in this. For example, one of the most notable ones right now is, what is that one? I literally just blanked on the name. Scanadu. That is the name. You know that little thing that you press to your forehead and it reads your vitals. And so there's a lot of teams, however, they're really secretive about what they've developed. So I was just like, oh, whatever, I'm going to totally go in with a bunch of high schoolers and be like the dream team from one of those movies and be like, team of high schoolers wins. But no. What's essentially happening is we have essentially gathered a team of high schoolers and we're working towards this, so it's pretty exciting what we've developed so far, and hopefully we can make it into the finals.
And when does that happen? When do you find out about that?
This coming April. And then we have another year to improve, and then they have, like, the final judging of, like, they have, like, 10 teams go to the finals and dukes it out for $10 million.
That's pretty cool.
So our first day of school is tomorrow. We get to see kids for the first time. We've had a couple months of summer. Their brain's going to be mush. If there's something you could tell kids around, let's just talk about kids in general around the country right now. Do you have a message for them, any kind of message that maybe would help them?
Well, I'm going into school in 2 days, so I can feel your pain. essentially, my advice would be really just try out something new this semester, maybe. Like, try and enter the science fair, join the math team, do math and science. It's fun, really. Do it. Or, like, just do something cool and new.
Cool.
Well, I know that when you Skyped in with my class, I think one of the things that you left them with that they talked about after you were gone was the constant message of, I'm not anybody incredible. I was just a regular kid who had something that affected me emotionally, and I wanted to do something extraordinary from that. And for my fifth graders to hear from another student that they are capable of anything, that they are capable of even the wildest dreams. I think that was a really powerful statement that you are out there making for kids, because I think a lot of the times kids don't hear that, especially teenagers.
Yeah, because a lot of the news things are like, whiz kid does this. I'm like, no, I'm not that smart, guys. I just, like, used Google and Wikipedia to do all this research. As a 15-year-old, I didn't know what a pancreas was. And so my really big message is telling people, just imagine what you could do. Like, 15-year-old Dumbo over here could make pancreatic cancer sensors. Imagine what you could do.
Yeah, that's cool. It's a good point. We got a question on Twitter. I'm going to go on ad lib here, Todd. But, Okay. Yeah, Craig Yin, he wanted to know if there was anything that you were working on with your brother. Is there any projects you guys are doing together?
So we've only partnered up once, and that was when I was in sixth grade, and it was for this environmental competition, and we finished first in state, but we didn't place nationally. So, I mean, we do some pretty cool stuff together. However, we don't usually, like, compete on a team. And so usually we go to each other for, like, advice on stuff. So he asks me all the biology and medicine questions. I ask him chemistry and physics questions. So that's kind of, like, the deal we worked out. But now he's in college, so, like, my sorts of chemistry and electronics and physics knowledge have, like, suddenly disappeared. I'm like, oh, no, now I have to learn on my own.
Now, is he going to college close or nearby?
Yeah, he's going to Virginia Tech in the Galileo program.
Okay, so you still get to see him pretty often then, at least.
Yeah. So it'll be fun.
So we always talk to our kids about making goals. Do you have a major goal for yourself this next year?
Oh,
Oh, we got one stumper in. Good.
Stumper, good.
Dude, what is my goal? My goal is to go to ISAF again. That is my goal.
So even though you won last year, in 2012, you can still go back again?
Oh, yeah. I went back 2013, this last year.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
What project did you take last year?
So last year it was something on ROM spectroscopy and being able to really make it available widespread. And so it wasn't my best project, and I didn't have really much time to prepare it. However, I still went, and it was super fun. I placed fourth in category, and I was proud of that. So.
Yeah, that's absolutely awesome.
So what do you do, like, when you're not saving the world?
What I do when I'm not saving the world? I watch Glee. I watch Bones. I watch some TV. I do kayaking. I'm on the National Junior Wild Boar team.
Cool.
And I fold origami. And recently, I've had a strange addiction with watching lots of movies.
Cool.
So what's the best movie you've seen recently?
Best movie I've seen. That's a hard one because I've been going through the Oscar list. I'm like, oh shoot. I would say the best movie I've watched recently is either The Help, A Time to Kill, or The Dark Knight Rises.
Those are all great choices.
Yeah, all great movies. Yeah. Are you allowed to watch Breaking Bad, or is that a you're not allowed to watch that one yet?
I can watch it. My parents are very lenient with what I watch. However, I just don't have time.
Yeah,
it's like having a TV baby, and you're just like, I have to put so much time and effort. Yeah. It's like keeping up, and then you miss one, and then you're just like, it's all downhill.
Yeah, Breaking Bad is an investment. Investment worthwhile, but an investment nonetheless.
Yeah.
Well, you kind of talked a little bit earlier about you being passionate about open source. Is there anything else right now that you're extremely passionate about?
So I'm really passionate about giving voice to youth, because a lot of the times we're teenagers like me, we're really not given a voice in a lot of the political decisions that are made or scientific decisions. And so that's one thing that I'm really passionate about, is giving us more of a voice in decision-making power. Because sometimes when kids like me go to Congress to say, oh, we want this issue resolved. Well, we're kids. We can't vote. So what do they care? They're like, ah, whatever. But some of them are very, very nice, like Barbara Mikulski. She's so nice. But so that's one of my big issues, is being able to have kids get more of a voice in the world.
Cool.
Well, Jack, we wanted to thank you for being in here and being our first student guest. It was really great getting to talk with you and hear from you and hear your story again. So thank you for joining us this evening.
Yeah, just a personal thank you for me. I mean, I'm an eighth grade science teacher, so this is an unbelievable story, and just an unbelievable story that I'm going to share with my own students, and really appreciate what you've done, and just congratulations. It's just an amazing accomplishment that you have under your belt.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure being on here. I loved it. Yeah.
And for all of you that are listening, we just want to share again with the ways that you can connect with us as listeners. You can check out Jack on Twitter at Jack Andraka, JACKANDRAKA. You can also find us on Twitter at EduAllStarsHQ, and we use the hashtag EduAllStars when we tweet out things. Our website is EduAllStars.com, where we will put all of this stuff up there in addition to some more info about Jack. And you can also find links to all of our episodes of EduAllStars on iTunes by searching EduAllStars, one word, no spaces.
Yeah, we've got some cool guests coming up in a couple of weeks. We're going to have author Todd Whitaker. And then I think it's not till December, but we're going to have Steve Spangler. Do you know who Steve Spangler is, Jack? Have you heard of him? No, maybe not. But yeah, he's an awesome science guy that really is has great science experience for getting into classes and stuff. And it's just really a cool guy. I think that's going to be a great interview as well.
And we're finalizing another big guest that hopefully on next week's episode we will get to announce. We're just waiting for...
Ooh, who is it?
We're waiting for the final...
It's a big one.
Okay, to announce who our guest is. We have to wait till we hear from them.
All right. Once again, you can leave a rating. If you've made it this far, we'd super appreciate it. And if you could leave a rating, it really, really, really helps us out. And just giving us our feedback, and it helps us to make shows better in the future. So thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks to Jack, and we'll see you soon.